As I was saying before, this isn't working. I can get this to work, otherwise I'll just have to sit down. As I said, today and next week we're going to see Longfellow in two separate moments. At the beginning of every author, I try to look for a quote from their work to bring it into perspective, to give us a kind of view into the work of the author. In this case, this is the story of a poet that was an enormous celebrity in his lifetime. And it's really strange to think about it, because if I go back to what I was saying before I started to record, I said in this semester we're going to talk about Edgar Allan Poe. Everybody will say, I know who he is. We're going to talk about Whitman. You would again say, I know exactly who you're talking about. Even if I'm not a huge fan of poetry, I've seen the Poet Society, and I'm exposed to his poetry. Oh, Captain, My Captain, People Standing on a Chair. I know what you're talking about. Emily Dickinson, of course, who doesn't know Emily Dickinson? The poems translate so well, and they're so universal that everybody can relate to them. And I would say, Longfellow. And you would say, Long who? And I would say, Longfellow. From the four authors that I'm going to mention, Longfellow was the only one that was successful during his lifetime, which is an irony and a paradox, because it comes to show how ephemeral literary reputation can be. You can be absolutely successful in life, and because of a change in taste, or because of a refinement in taste, or because of higher expectations for literary figures, for an author that was considered one of the main exponents of romantic poetry, to be left aside and to be considered a minor figure. Nowadays, Longfellow's reputation no longer exists as a mainstream author, as an important member of the American literary canon. That is because a change of taste, I would say a sophistication of taste. Readers are more demanding. Readers want less of the exotic entertainment, and they want more of the literary quality. And for the same reasons that Edgar Allan Poe or Herman Melville, to put two examples, were tremendously unsuccessful during their lifetime, or were tremendously unsuccessful with their most relevant works. For example, Edgar Allan Poe, we've already talked about his miserable life and how he appeared dead in a ditch after 24 hours, disappeared in very strange circumstances that nobody has been able to explain, and there is all type of urban legends about him, or how Herman Melville devoted an entire year to rewriting a work because he thought that he had at last got right about what literary quality was, and when he reshaped a book that was going to be called The Whale into Moby Dick, and that book transformed into his biggest failure in life as an author. So this just goes to show that what happens during your lifetime isn't the resemblance of the legacy that you can leave behind, especially in literature. And we're going to see several cases of these, such as this one. We've already seen a few in the first semester. The second semester is about this, about authors that are rediscovered, reinstated into a position of honor. And Edgar Allan Poe, I think, would be absolutely amazed by his current status and his current reputation. The same can be said about Walt Whitman, who tried to create the poetry for the people and faced the cold reception of the people. So only at the very end of his life did Walt Whitman begin to receive the recognition that he aspired to have during his entire life. For most of his life, he was considered unsuccessful. He was considered provocative, sincere to talk about things that writers shouldn't be talking about, like homosexuality, free love, things that are going to be very inspirational for the generations. For example, the Beat Generation. The Beat Generation is a generation that occurs in the 1950s, and they come right after the modernists. The modernists are the successors of the realist, romanticism, realism, modernism. So the Beat Generation, instead of looking at the generation that preceded them, looked all the way back to the romantics and said, we want to be like Walt Whitman. We want to, we aspire to be like those poets that were outsiders and that were outcasts of society. Because the Beat Generation was a countercultural generation. In the same way, Whitman and Dickinson, in different ways, are countercultural. Whitman is countercultural because he decides to reinvent and reestablish the way that he understands poetry. He's going to drop the rhyme. He's going to go for free verse. In the case of Dickinson, she's going to compress the verse. She's going to be inspired by other types of authors, and she's going to be very innovative and very experimental with her poetry. Why am I talking about Walt Whitman and Dickinson when I should be talking about Longfellow? Because Longfellow was exactly the opposite. Longfellow was amazing. He was like the pop musician versus the indie musicians. He did the type of poetry that people were expecting to read. The name of the poetic circle that he belonged to is one that you might remember when you read about Nathaniel Hawthorne. Nathaniel Hawthorne was sick of, and it's almost a quote, the mob of scribbling women that wrote about romantic topics. Romantic topics, or topics that were easy and not controversial, were what the general public was demanding. And there was a lot of female writers that were emerging to fill that void and provide that type of literature. In the poetic circle, there was a group of poets that were very much in the mainstream, very much writing the type of poetry that people wanted to read in that period. They were called the Fireside Poets, okay, which I think is very descriptive of the type of poetry that they created. The Fireside Poets are poets that are good for reading on a comfortable armchair next to the fire with your friends and your family, and enjoy these beautiful and comfortable topics to just relax and enjoy. They weren't poems to make you think. They were just poems to make you enjoy. Okay, and maybe that way of not questioning the establishment, of not innovating, of not trying to experiment and go further, is the biggest criticism that Longfellow received, and that is responsible for why Longfellow is no longer a major literary figure in American literature. Going back to Longfellow, we have a few objectives in this unit. We're going to place this right. We're going to try to analyze the shift that starts to occur with Longfellow, and that Longfellow is a victim of this shift in poetic taste, and understand why Longfellow fell from grace. There was something new happening in American literature. We know that 1850 is a peak moment for Trump's, but also the generation of poets that were going to arrive are precursors of modernism, the precursors of what is to come, a very experimental, very innovative type of poet. And Longfellow is exactly the opposite. Longfellow is the same mechanisms and the same devices that we've been seeing in English poetry for the last centuries. And that might remind us more to Phyllis Wheatley or to Anne Bradstreet, with that type of simplicity and those type of imagery that do not go beyond what is more obvious for the reader. We're going to try to comprehend Longfellow's success during his lifetime and how he gained the credit of the American public. We're going to examine his technical skill, that from a technical point of view is superb, and how he had a complete control of meter, rhythm, and rhyme. But what we're going to see is that Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson, the first thing they're going to drop is the meter and the rhyme. So going beyond the meter and the rhyme is the opposite of what Longfellow was proposing. A Psalm of Life is the poem that you have to read for this unit, and I think it's going to provide us enough reading material to be able to understand why the generation Longfellow belonged to favored his type of poetry, and why his poetry has fallen out of grace ever since. We're going to define some key components in poetry, and they're going to be very helpful because they're going to help us understand the poetry that is to come. The literary devices, the literary figures that we're going to use are going to be these and others and others. But you should already be familiar with most of these ideas just by having studied Ann Bradstreet or Phyllis Wheatley. But I've been a student and I know how complicated it is to stay up to date with all your subjects. You might not remember what a caesura, what an anaphora, what an enjambment is, and this is a good moment to just stop, pause, and recap on those concepts to make them familiar with you again and to help you understand the poetry better. I don't know, do you feel comfortable reading poetry? And you said yes, it's Victoria, right? Victoria, you said, were you familiar with Longfellow? Were you familiar with Longfellow? Okay. Do you feel comfortable reading poetry, Alejandro? Okay. Okay. What about you, Miguel Angel? And the author, okay. So which ones are the easier ones? The older ones or the more modern ones? Which ones do you understand better? The more recent poets or the older poets? Which ones do you like more? Yes? Okay. What about you? You want to sign this one? Sorry? Uh-huh. Yes, just understanding the real message and understanding the underlying message, understanding the literary figures, the metaphors, the symbols. That's probably the challenging part. What about you? Yes. Okay. Were you familiar with Longfellow? And more? Okay. Interesting. Besides these literary devices, we're going to see other literary devices over the following during this week and the next week. You might remember that when we refer to Bowdoin College, he had a classmate of a certain name, Nathaniel Hawthorne, which was his lifelong friend, Longfellow, Hawthorne, and future President Pierce all went to the same class. So it's remarkable how much talent or how much influence was condensed in one same school, in one same classroom. But at the same time, it's not so remarkable that there was, we already talked about this, this sort of elite institutions where most of the leaders, of the spiritual leaders, political leaders of the future study because they belong to the influential families. And It is quite a coincidence that three figures that are very important for American history went to the same class, but it's not so remarkable when we take into consideration that the governing class and the leading spiritual class, they tended to send their children to the same institutions. In the case of Longfellow, we've seen that in the case of Hawthorne, there was someone going against the grain. He wasn't willing to bind to the rules. He was kind of a rebel and sought the complicated path to become an author. In the case of Longfellow, somebody who goes by the way. Obedient guy. He tries to do his thing. He obtained his degree, and he was offered a 5-year tenure to teach modern languages. The thing is that we'll see this again. I think it's with Henry James. In the case of Henry James, biography, there's a very similar episode. To be able to teach in an institution, you had to spend a certain period, what was called normally a sojourn. It means a period abroad where you're training. I really like these old style companies. I hope there were still some left. To be able to accept a multi-year job, you had to spend several years outside becoming a better professional. So that it sounds like a good plan to me, at least. The sojourn required to spend 3 years in Europe specializing in modern languages. So that's why he became familiar not only with the languages of Europe, with French, with Spanish, with Italian, but also with the culture, with the literature of foreign countries, and that made him more familiar with other authors. We've already spoken, for example, about how he was so impressed by Calderón de la Barca's work that he decided to include it in one of his poems that has turned into his biggest legacy in life. He graduated in 1825, and he spent 3 years in Spain, Italy, and Germany from 1826 to 1829. On page 269 of your textbook, Professor Gibert explains that Longfellow during his lifetime was one of the most famous poets in English-speaking countries and as popular as Tennyson. So he was a major literary figure in that time. He contributed to the so-called flowering of New England by writing about the American scene and dealing with general themes which appealed to a very wide audience all around the world. So what we see is that in the case of Longfellow, we have an extremely relevant figure of his time that is contributing very significantly to fill the void that we talked about in previous weeks. From the time of Washington Irving and Fillmore Cooper, there was nothing to write about, and sometimes authors like, for example, Nathaniel Hawthorne had the feeling that they had to fill that void that they saw in American literature, that lack of stories, that lack of something that was American. So in the case of Longfellow, the term that is normally used, and I think it's really interesting if you like underlining your book, you underline that idea, the flowering of New England. Okay, it's like he brought the knowledge of New England to the mainstream. Sorry that the board writes so funny. Seems like if I have, I don't know, Parkinson or something like that. He spent the most of 1827 in Spain and met Washington Irving. So at the same time, we see another literary figure that is very relevant and that also had this European taste and this love not only for Europe, but in particular for Spain. Washington Irving and was influenced by his choice of theme. Remember that Washington Irving was is probably the precursor of the modern short story, of the American short story, one of the most important genres in literary history. And what he did was use foreign folk to create a transfer type of American folk. And he also wrote about topics that he found, for example, in Spain. We've already talked about Alhambra as a set of short stories that he wrote because of the appeal that Spain had for him. So he met Washington Irving and was also influenced by his choice of topics. He became Smith Professor. Normally, these type of positions have a certain name of modern languages at Harvard University, and after finishing at Bowdoin, and he was required again to leave the country and spend 1 year to 18 months in Europe. During that period, tragedy hits, and we're going to see this again. Sometimes when you study the biography of these authors, you get a sort of a deja vu feeling. It's like, there is sometimes very strange parallelism between one author and others. You'll see in a few weeks how I'm right about this. Now, he was struck by tragedy when his wife died after 6 months in Europe. He remarried and had children. He abandoned teaching in 1855 to be able to write full-time. Remember that this period around 1826 is when Washington Irving is beginning to be well-known and established. And this period is a golden period of Romanticism, of American literature. That's right the years after Edgar Allan Poe has published. Nathaniel Hawthorne has published The Scarlet Letter and is starting to publish Twice Told Tales. Moby Dick has already been published. So this is a period where American literature is starting to be the focus for the entire world of culture, where the symbolists are looking toward, or what is going to be symbolism, is looking towards the United States and the literary scene of the United States as a source of inspiration, where the Russian writers are looking at American literature as a source of inspiration. In this point, and also Longfellow contributed to that point, because he was very successful during his lifetime, is when American literature starts to be extremely relevant for the world. And it's probably never going to leave that peak of success from that moment forward, because it stops importing genres and it starts exporting them. It's not only genres, but also literary movements. It's going to be at the front of modernism. It's going to be at the front of realism. It's going to be at the front of postmodernism. It's going to create movements that are partially literary and partially political, like the Beat Generation, the Hippie Generation, the Civil Rights Generation. The fight for racial equality, the fight for feminism. This is, if there is ever a tipping point in American history, I think you have to look for the tipping point here. One century before, it really becomes obvious to the world that American culture and American politics, that combination of culture and politics, is something that the rest of the world is looking towards America to see what they're doing and maybe establish parallel movements, because this is a moment when American culture and American literature stops following and begins to get followed. It stops looking at English culture and English literature as a model to imitate, and it starts to create their own themes. This can be said, I would say, only partially, because of course, England will still exert a very powerful counterbalance and a very, very powerful influence over American literature. But I think that at this point, it's when it starts to be a relationship of equal to equal. For that moment, American literature was like the embarrassing little brother of English literature. And from this mid-19th century is when it shifts. And even though Longfellow no longer has that type of reputation, he is responsible for a part of this shift, of course. His work in 1859, as you can see, he's a fringe author in the middle of the authors that published at the beginning of the 1830s and the authors that published the bulk of their work towards the 1850s. In 1839, published Voices of the Night. Voices of the Night includes his most famous poem, the poem we're going to study in this unit, A Psalm of Life. As you can see, he took a stance on slavery, I probably should have crossed that out because the problem with Longfellow is that he wanted to be too mainstream. And when you try to be too mainstream, there is a moment where you probably find people at either end of the feelings, or at either end of the way something is perceived, that both disagree with you. Some disagree with you because you're not making too much of a stance against something, and the others are disagreeing with you because you're making a stance against something. His poems on slavery dissatisfied everyone. They dissatisfied abolitionists because it was a set of poems that were supposed to be against slavery, and they also dissatisfied the abolitionist movement because they weren't considered strong enough to fight against the slavery movement. So nobody was happy with his poems on slavery, and I think that can be an anticipation of why his reputation fell from grace after his death. The poem Evangeline, A Tale of Acadie, is a long narrative poem. It has a sort of epic touch to it. I think we read the song of Yalta. Don't we? I don't remember because I don't know. It's not that one. It's incredible how short this unit is and compared to how long the rest of them are. No, there's only one poem in this author. If ever there is a poem that that describes why later generations stop reading Longfellow is because he had a need to satisfy layers of population that he really didn't understand. And we already saw this with Emerson, for example, when he decided to use the Hindi references in his poems, but some of those Hindi references were failed. But since there wasn't a big Hindi population in the United States, nobody could point that out and say, Emerson, you're doing a very bad job at trying to sound Hindi or Oriental because you're wrong about many concepts. Nobody's going to say that. But in the case of Longfellow, we get the same feeling maybe that we might get with Fenimore Cooper, that he was out of his comfort zone writing about things that we really did not understand through indirect references and making many failed or incorrect choices when choosing to speak about certain topics. He's author of two novels and one play. The play is called The Spanish Students. He anthologized poetry from France Spain and Italy, and he's responsible for a lot of that poetry being known, like I think of Jota de Foco Manrique or Calderón de la Barca, for those types of poets to be exposed to the American public and the American public gaining knowledge about relevant authors of Spanish literature are because of the work of Longfellow. I wrote that, in fact, and I wasn't reading that. He translated the Coplas of Jorge Manrique in 1833 and the Divine Comedy. I don't remember if you have to read the Divine Comedy in one of your subjects, but it's maybe the Paradise Lost, but the Divine Comedy, yeah. Undoubtedly, very relevant works from international literature that would have only residually reached the American audience had it not been for the work of Longfellow. So Longfellow's figure is very important, I think, for the moment. But afterwards, the importance that he has as an author in the big picture can only be minor. Okay. I don't know how well we're doing on time. We should probably stop here. What's next? I'm going to leave it here. We're going to come back here to read about the Fireside Poets. I'll try to bring something from Lowell as well, which is not or Whittier and Lowell, because they're not in the course, because normally selecting 24 authors from the entire body of American literature up to the 1900 is really a complicated task. But it might be interesting just from the perspective of knowing more about American literature to be able to compare and see not only A Psalm of Life but maybe another work. And we'll look into that the next week. I'm going to stop the recording now. We'll adjourn on this topic.